Welcome to another edition of Anglican Unscripted, episode 848. I'm Kevin Carlson.
I'm George Conger. Today is March 19th, 2024.
All right, welcome to another show of Anglican Unscripted. We are very glad you could be here and join us as we tell you the news that's going on around the world. This is Kevin and George's happy place. We sit down and read the news that we find interesting around the world on our little webcams, and many of you seem to like that. Some of you agree with us completely about our take. Some of you kind of slightly agree with us, and some of you, a very small portion of the audience, think we're completely idiots. And we love that you think that we're idiotic enough that you can come and join us. So we do appreciate that. The show here does not end when I press the stop button and I upload it. People go to the comments, and there's wonderful conversations that happen each episode in the comments. And each episode goes for 2 or 3 weeks with all the comments that occur. We really appreciate that. We really read every comment, and we respond to those that we need to respond to. Let's see. Oh, what should you do if you're a viewer of Anglican Unscripted? Like us. If you're watching the live stream or you're watching an episode or whatever, just click that little like button. It tells YouTube or Facebook that we are something worth watching, that they can do free advertising for us, and it's really appreciated. If you have not done so yet, and some 22% of you have not, subscribe to the show. There's a little red rectangle here right now. You click on that, and it turns into a bell. You click the bell, you will be instantly notified every time I upload a new episode of Anglican Unscripted. I know some of you have technical issues, and that's a YouTube thing. Don't worry about me. If you have not shared Anglican Unscripted with a dear friend yet, it's time. Let them know, you come out of the closet, that you are an Unscripted viewer. I'm Carl, and I watch Unscripted. Just send that link. And they could be somebody who watches Unscripted too. I'm Carl's friend, and I watch Unscripted. Go for it. Don't let that be something you don't do. Share. George, how you doing this week?
I'm running around with my head cut off. It's a busy time. Yeah. Palm Sunday is this Sunday. I've also got a Kairos team meeting. It's about 6 hours preparing for a weekend at our local prison here in Florida. And so just the time is just running right out of my hands to get things done.
However, you took time out of your schedule, you and your dear wife, to meet me at Catfish Johnny's to have some dinner this last week. That was a lot of fun.
Well, actually, no, I got cheese on my shirt and beer on my pants, so I have to drop them at the cleaners. So it was expensive in more ways than just the food.
It was fun. Oh, it was a lot of fun. So every once in a while, George and I, we live like an hour away from each other, but we can't get together a lot because he is an extremely busy priest and I'm a guy trying to fix my RV every other day. So it just doesn't work out that well. So it's fun when we can get together on Thanksgiving and one time before we leave. We are leaving Florida, George. We're out of here the first week of April. We're going to head north. I'll announce more of our travel plans as we make them. As we get close to that date, I will be looking for ACNA churches along the way and friends that want to hit up and grab a coffee, friends of the show. So look forward to that. Let's go down here and check out the news. For the second time, George has put together the show notes, and they are very well laid out. Bullet point one, insert tab A, B, C, D. So, slavery reparations not being well received over in the Church of England or in England anywhere. And there's some comments from Lord Sewell that we need to talk about, George.
God, this story is not dying. To the horror of the Church of England, the flap over the call for £1 billion to be spent on slavery reparations, plus apologizing for evangelizing the African indigenous people, bringing them into the Christian faith, has gone over like a lead balloon. And now we're 3-4 weeks out, and we're still seeing editorials in the major newspapers, comments on television. And we had an interview with Lord Tony Sewell of Sanderston, And Lord Sewall is a black Englishman, and he chaired the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities, what was also called CRED, like street cred, which was set up by Boris Johnson in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests. And Lord Sewall basically took the Church of England to task. He said the decision to start the reparation fund was political. In his interview with the Times, he said the church has started the fund for show. And he said the C of E should get back to getting people into the pews. Now, I'll read a quote from the piece. Lord Sewall said, "We need to have a conversation with the Archbishop and ask what he's doing. It would be so much better to focus on bringing people back to a time when the church was packed." So here is an unexpected blow from a leading black British man saying that, you know, get off this political high horse, this virtue signaling that you're doing, and get to work on winning Britain for Christ. Now, this had even prompted the press department at the Church of England to release a one-paragraph statement saying that we don't regret evangelizing African pagans. We don't regret that. But if you compare the amount of time they spent in promoting this reparations committee report and their now shamefaced climb down, oh, they know that they're in trouble.
It's kind of like watching wax on, wax off. You know, one week it's wax on, the other week it's, oh, we didn't mean that. We meant that, we don't mean this. And it's strange to watch them. It's like the Pope's press department for the first 2 years of his officiating. Every time he'd say something, he didn't mean that, he meant something else. Well, we've given up on trying to figure out what Justin Welby means or what the Church of England means. Because all they're trying to do is virtual signal. And there's just no gospel in that. There's no headway in that. Because all you can do every day is wake up and find out what in the news today can I virtue signal on. And this week and this month, it's reparations, George.
Well, there's a whiff of sulfur about the leadership of the Church of England. Yes. What do I mean by that? There's Satan has entered into the room. They have capitulated to the prince of this world and are pursuing ends to achieve a utopia here and now. They're seeking to march towards a bright uplands where we can all together have wonderful things happen. And they've forgotten that their task is not social reform. It's proclaiming the good news of Jesus Christ. They've been captured by the world. And ever since they've been captured by the world, they have been in free fall. They have made decisions that were not godly, and they have allowed the world to dictate what is right and wrong, not telling us we're at the point now that a faithful, Bible-believing Christian can say something that can get himself arrested for hate speech. And the Church of England is silent. The Church of England is silent about the rise of Islamist extremism and political activism in Britain. Ever since the massacres in Israel, October 7th, we've seen protests led by the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign. And half the people there are your usual weird beard, vegan, sandal-wearing, you know, fruity toots who were around for the Council on Nuclear Disarmament and all that stuff. The women of Granham Common and all that, you know, those kooks never go away. So they all will always march. But now they got 125,000 Muslim immigrants marching through London, making it a Jew-free zone, making it a Christian-free zone. There's a little thing where the Greenwich Council is demanding that a man with a fish and chip shops who has a British flag and on the outside of his store and just an old-fashioned traditional John Bull type fish and chips shop to paint it over because it offends the locals. Who are the locals? Muslims who despise Britishness. We've reached the point where I believe that the man in the street, or as the man in the white van, the tradesman in England, he's done with the Church of England. He's not done with Christianity. He's not done with Jesus Christ. And he may not be done with his local vicar and his faith community, but he is certainly done with that hierarchy of archbishops and bishops and archdeacons and committees and commissions. And he looks at, like, you know, the Diocese of Truro, 37 full-time clergy with 35 diocesan staff supporting them. And he says, you know, how does this have anything to do with my salvation?
Well, I think the man on the street also recognizes that the Church of England's leadership is more in love with Karl Marx than they are with the gospel. They're more in love with finding a utopia through social action, finding a utopia by doing good things rather than what they believe in and whom they follow and who they proclaim to be Lord in Christ. And you're slowly seeing this being revealed in the press now, that, yep, the Church of England is completely off course and it has lost its way. We knew this a long time ago. But it seems that the British press is, wait a minute, the Church of England's off course, you know, and they're surprised by it, but you and I are not.
Well, this reparations business makes people feel under attack. They're under attack at home by domestic extremists, the rise of Islamist aggressiveness, such that a few weeks ago, Parliament was actually influenced by a Muslim mob outside on a vote on whether or not to condemn the war in Gaza or to demand a ceasefire. And the Speaker of the House of Commons, along with the Labour Party leader, basically cut a deal so that they could get out of the building without getting murdered. When Parliament is in fear of the mob in the street, democracy is gone. It's dead. And the average British man and woman sees this, and they see their institutions, things that they had trusted, things that had been sort of there for them always, gone. Part of that is I don't mean to blame Prince Charles, King Charles, but at least the Queen stood for something. You know, honor, duty, courage, decency, the virtues that got Britain through the war, and she was a remarkable, godly person. Mm-hmm. And now we've got Workshy Will, and we've got King Charles, and we've got Harry, and we've basically got a cartoon, playing out. And so the things that you could once trust and take pride and allegiance to, church and country, and, you know, is England the land of hope and glory anymore? Well, I don't think you're allowed to sing that in many parts of London.
Well, I think people will be surprised that, you know, people are arrested by the thousands in England for offending people, for posting hate speech on social media, where over in Russia, you're only arrested in the hundreds. And I'm talking about numbers from 2021. I don't have the recent 2024 numbers, but it's appalling by how much being offended has taken over the judiciary and the laws of Europe, and certainly the shores of the British, UK. So I can't help you if you don't have the freedom of speech. That was something that was fought for so many centuries, and it's completely eroded in a time when the UK doesn't have a Conservative Party. They have, I don't know what they are. Conservative name only. I don't get them, you know?
Well, there was a funny little thing that to me is almost emblematic of the state both the United States and Britain are in. In Haiti, we talked about this last week, where Barbecue, the gang leader who now running Port-au-Prince, there's some videos of he and his men eating their enemies after killing them and roasting them. Well, NBC and the BBC and a bunch of other left-wing outlets, you know, denied vociferously that any cannibalism was taking place in Haiti, and that it was shown on video and reported. And there was an old Monty Python routine about the British Navy, where I think it's it was either John Cleese or Graham Chapman who said that, dressed up as an officer, saying there is no cannibalism in the British Navy. And by that, I mean there's only a very small bit of cannibalism. You can't trust the BBC, you can't trust NBC, you can't trust the Church of England, you can't trust the Episcopal Church, you can't trust the American government. Goodness me, you can't trust the FBI. You and I grew up in the age of Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and the TV show FBI, where they were the straightest of square shooters. Yeah. Joe Friday, would have, though he was LAPD, that was the model, incorruptible, wholly dedicated to justice and the law. Yeah. Now what do we have? We've got these cases in Los Angeles when there have been seizures of assets and people find thousands of dollars of cash missing from their houses, and FBI agents were pocketing money they stole. And the government is basically saying, oops, we'll discipline these guys. These are FBI agents stealing from people's homes when they're collecting evidence.
Well, in the late 80s, we put into law something called asset forfeiture, that if you are caught transporting large sums of cash across the country in your car or flying from place to place, it can be assumed that large caches of cash are drug-related or crime-related and can be confiscated by the government, and you have to prove to the government that it's not of ill means to get that cash back. They can take it and say, you need to prove that this $100,000 that's in your car belongs to you and was not gotten by ill gains. Well, that violates the principles of our Constitution, which says innocent until proven guilty. You can't take, we can. And this has been something that goes on here and has allowed police departments to take money out of cars in the $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $200,000 range and use it to fund their police department, because ill-gotten gains can be used to fund our first responders. And this has been going on since the 80s. And very few cases.
But now we're at the point where we've got officers funding the purchase of powerboats and vacation homes with money that they've taken in asset forfeiture.
George, I wish we had a show of good news. It'd be a 10-minute show, but whatever. Okay, let's move on to story number two. St. Thomas, Fifth Avenue, New York, may close historic choir school. Is this a sign of the times? Now, we talk all the time about one of the worst parts of the Episcopal Church is it has very rich churches. They don't have to be well attended, but they have endowments. They either have, if they don't have endowments, they have land that they rent to Wall Street and make money that way. And they have funds available to them. So even if they're preaching a false gospel, they have the money. And yeah, but that's not always going to work in every situation. And here we have a false gospel church on Fifth Avenue that's saying, okay, we got the money, but we don't have complete access to all of it at any one time. Maybe we should try reaching people, George.
The big three in terms of financial strength in New York City are Trinity Wall Street, which has never had many people because of its location in downtown Wall Street area. It has always had tens and hundreds of millions of dollars in assets. Mm-hmm. St. Bart's, St. Bartholomew's the East Side. It's always been sort of on the liberal, trendy side, big parish.
Artsy-fartsy.
The third one was St. Thomas Fifth Avenue, New York City, and that was always the traditional one. They've had a choir school for going on 75, 80 years, maybe even longer, I'm not certain. But it was always sort of the high church, conservative one. Well, the previous rector, and I'm not going to say his name, not the current one, the previous rector, he took the church in the gay direction. He brought in gay assistants, people who love the liturgy and all this and that. And the result has been St. Thomas has been in decline, genteel decline. Their current rector came 10 years ago, and he's a music man. And the school's famous for the beauty of its liturgy, its choir, its boys' choir, its music. Well, the rector in the vestry sent out a letter this past week saying, we may have to close the choir school. And in the Q&A put out by the vestry, they answered possible questions. The parish has a $138 million endowment and an annual budget of $14 million. However, even they cannot make the wheels go round. They announced they're deferring $4 million in building maintenance. They've cut $250,000 out of one program. And they're saying that we can't, and people say, well, just pay it out of the $138 million. Well, they can't because they're limited to a 5% drawdown. And much of the money is
restricted,
designated for certain, restricted for certain projects and things. And here's the closing sentence in their letter the vestry wrote. Putting it simply, the money's running out and the vestry has a responsibility to take action now rather than seeing the general fund completely expended. So the problem is that though it has a beautiful location, a beautiful building, a beautiful tradition, beautiful history, it's not a place of Christian dynamism. It's a place of entertainment. It's cheaper than going to the Metropolitan Opera or Carnegie Hall to see classical music, to go to the church. It's a museum. And its people who are members are no longer able or willing or enough of them to keep it going. So in many ways, this is emblematic of the Episcopal Church as a whole. It has, the Episcopal Church nationally has billions of dollars in assets and has all these beautiful history and traditions and buildings and liturgies and this and that. But the people are fleeing and the money is going to disappear and run out sooner rather than later. And we're seeing it here in the flesh at St. Thomas Fifth Avenue.
I want to back up to the 1990s, George. In the 1990s, I went to a parish in Watertown, Connecticut, called Christ Church Parish. That parish, up until 2003, we'll get to that in a second, had an average weekly attendance in the 300s. The pews were full, the people were happy, we had a choir, everything was working, and then Gene Robinson was consecrated, and the church instantly went, and the church was known as a conservative church. Let's not, you know, parse around that. In the Diocese of Connecticut at the time, there were six, seven, maybe eight, I'll give you 10, 10 conservative churches amongst the 170. And our church is one of the prideful conservative churches. Gene Robinson happened, and we went to 60 within a couple weeks. And that killed the church, and we started to have to, from our remainder of the time in that church, draw on the endowment fund. Until it was gone, until we couldn't support the building, until we had to turn the building over to the bishop and go rent space. At you know, we were a healthy church. We were, if Gene Robinson had not happened, we would have stayed in that church and it would continue to grow. We could continue to maintain it and continue to meet the needs of the people of Watertown, Connecticut. That stopped. It's also stopped now for this church on Fifth Avenue. They don't have the ability to meet the needs of the people around them, so they don't come to church. They don't give to the church. They're just scattered and gone. I don't know why. I'm not going to blame Gene Robinson on that. It's probably a plethora of other reasons, George. But this used to be the conservative church on Fifth Avenue.
You know, New York City itself is having a hard time. Taxes and the crime and all this and that. So we don't want to put... You know, there are a multitude of factors that leads to church decline. But I think the bigger overall picture is that money is no safeguard or no guarantee of long-term survival. If you've lost the people, the money will keep you alive a little bit longer. You know, they'll get rid of the choir school. They'll go from six clergy to four clergy to three clergy and so on and so forth. They'll sell off their air rights above the building. They'll sell off the rectories. And they'll be able to raise cash, but they're in the direction of terminal decline. And it's just a question of when, unless there is some sort of revival in the people's hearts.
And that's the biggest problem. When you start hanging up that rainbow flag within your church, it doesn't come with money. It doesn't come with people. It's just virtual signaling. And that in my humble opinion, seems to be what happened here. George, our next story is a good story. We're going to talk about
for some bad for others.
good, bad. It talks about the trajectory of the Anglican Communion, like tech and the Anglican Church in Canada. But the ACNA faithfully publishes their numbers every year. And if you look at the trend from 15 years ago to now, it's a continued growth spurt. Oh, we all have 2020, no big deal. You know, it happened. And it's going up and up and up and up. And something caught your attention, and you started blasting emails back and forth to myself and Andrew Gross in the middle of the last week and said, is this true? Can this be true? What's going on here? And you put together that the Anglican Church of Canada is now smaller than the ACNA. What?
Yes. The Anglican Church of Canada, the Anglican Church in North America, which includes the United States and Canada in northern Mexico.
Sure,
parts of northern Mexico around Monterey and whatnot, publishes its memberships and attendance statistics. The Anglican Church of Canada, a few years ago, stopped publishing its statistics. Well, basically a statistician, a demographer, was able to compile the latest statistics of the Anglican Church of Canada. And their average Sunday attendance is 65,000, I'm using round numbers. The ACNA's attendance is 75,000, round numbers. The ACNA, which is 15 years old, is now bigger, has more butts in the pews than the Anglican Church of Canada. And if you look at the individual diocesan statistics, there's some dioceses that are just, how should I put it? It shouldn't be dioceses, you know. Why have a diocese of 340 members?
Yeah.
So that, you know, there's going to have to be some amalgamation in the Anglican Church of Canada just to keep the lights on. Toronto's fine, but, you know, Vancouver has, you know, when they drove out St. John's Shaughnessy, the big evangelical ACA parish.
Huge parish. Yeah.
I don't want to exaggerate, but essentially they cut their attendance in half, and it's not come back. It's not come back at all. And here's another scary statistic. Again, round numbers, 295,000 members on parish rolls in Canada. Attendance of 65,000. What's that, 22%?
22%, yeah, about that.
ACNA has 125,000 members and attendance of 75,000. It shows that the people they have are more dedicated, more committed. You know, they didn't break out the numbers of children, but I would guarantee you the ACNA has many, many more children. What we're seeing here is this is very bad news for the Anglican Church of Canada. Its demography is destiny. When you're not reproducing, putting younger people in the pew, young people don't give as much as old people. They cost more to maintain Sunday schools and whatnot. But they're the future. And the Anglican Church of Canada appears not to have a future based upon these demographic numbers.
Which is probably why they haven't put out their numbers in 5 or 6 years. I think once they broke 100,000 ASA, probably 5 years ago, they stopped publishing. Because you can see the trajectory. And they, you know, they said, well, if we hear no evil, see no evil. See, you know, I mean, at some point they just said, we're not going to tell you. And we hope that it changes. And it hasn't. Hasn't changed at all. Let's go on here to story 4. The Church Times has conducted a survey finding a volunteer crisis hitting the Church of England. It found that amongst those that replied to the survey, 25 to 40% of parishes had only one church warden. Now we're talking wardens. You need a senior and a junior warden to serve. And between 5 and 21% had none. Well, okay, in my understanding, the wardens are there for the temporal responsibility of the church, what's temporary. the priests are there for what's eternal. And so if you can't have people there in the Church of England helping volunteer to keep what's going on within the church business going on, it's going to collapse even faster, George.
Yeah, the Church Times study found that in one diocese, 50 to 60% of the parishes had difficulty getting people even to serve on the parish council, which is the equivalent to the vestry in the United States and Canada. The article was basically suggesting that the weight of responsibility for the buildings, for safeguarding, for raising funds from dwindling congregations, is proving too high a challenge for people. The amount of paperwork and busy work required by the national church is driving away people, as well as the actions. It's very hard to get rid of people from your local church. You can have people despise the leadership, thumb their nose at the bishop. But to get them out of their church, or get them to break with the something that's a lifelong habit, takes a lot of work. And the demands of the Church of England, and I think of its paperwork and bureaucracy, who wants to have to raise money continuously to maintain these historic but expensive buildings that may not have electricity or toilets in some cases? Who wants to go through all this safeguarding rigmarole when you have two kids who show up on Sunday and you've got to go through all these forms and paperwork, or you've now got to have a plan for capturing or increasing the number of minority Anglicans in your church? Well, in rural Hereford, that's going to be a big job, but you still have to turn in the paperwork. I don't know why, but the leadership just seems to be doing its best to destroy from within the institution.
Well, I think they've lost their core. Every church has its core 20, 30, 50 people who do a lot of the busy work, the volunteer work. In your church, you probably have a set of people who are always doing the volunteer work. And then you have the outside of that realm, the people who like to attend and participate in what the core have provided. And it keeps the church functioning. Here in Anglican Unscripted, we have a core 500 or 600 viewers who watch every second of every show. Praise God. I thank the Lord for you and your viewership. I love it very much. But you're the core. The Church of England has lost that core. The people who would, even if it's troublesome to go through the paperwork and do all this extra work, would do it because they love Jesus, they love the gospel, they love the church, and it's worth it. People have lost that desire to see that it's worth it. They've lost the core. And that's what's happened here, George.
Now, the problem is not the lady here, okay? Nope. I don't want to be up on people. Yeah. The problem here are archbishops, bishops, and priests are... This is leaf raking season here in Florida, so this analogy comes quickly to mind.
Yes, it does.
Raking leaves in the morning. They flutter off the trees, and the bishops, archbishops, and priests are descending straight to hell because they are not Christian anymore. They don't have Christ centered in their hearts. And it's the failure of the clergy, all clergy, has now caused a reaction among the laity who would actually do the work of the church in the temporal matters, the plant and equipment and Sunday schools and coffee hours and visiting the sick and whatnot. It's caused a reaction. The failure of the priestly class has caused this reaction among the lay people. And it's and it does not bode well.
Does not.
Jesus, come quickly. This is the answer.
Story 5. The Episcopal Church is soliciting nominations for presiding bishop for their Louisville General Convention this summer. The names will be announced next month. On the other side of the coin here, the ACNA is also going to be seeking a new archbishop for the Anglican Church in North America when they meet in Latrobe, Pennsylvania in June. So Sign of the times. The church continues on. The ACNA is strong. It's growing. It's mature. It's now 15 years old. How old does that make you and I, George? Holy cow. We've been doing this since I knew the ACNA before they were ACNA, you know. But so, in as such, it's very difficult to watch an archbishop go and a new archbishop come in. And when Archbishop Duncan was the leader of the ACNA, we were comfortable. He's the lion. He's the guy who could bring everybody together. And we watched Archbishop Foley Beach come in office. Ooh, what's going to happen to him? He's going to be eaten alive. No, he wasn't. He did a very good job. You know, he still had to deal with the elephant in the room. And even under Archbishop Foley's tenure, they had a meeting on the elephant in the room and decided we're going to keep the elephant in the room. But as such, I'm very pleased that through the Holy Spirit, through the conclave, through the wisdom of the College of Bishops for the ACNA, they were able to choose fully, and now they're going to have to make a choice again. On the other side of the coin, they're going to be doing this in the Episcopal Church, and we've seen some winners and losers over there, George.
Kevin, I think the deeper point that you're making,
yes,
is spot on.
Yes,
it matters whom the Holy Spirit leads, yeah, leads the bishop in the ACNA to choose, because a bad archbishop can kill the ACNA. Bob Duncan, yeah, I knew he was the bishop who ordained me 30 odd years ago, and I didn't know Foley Beach. I knew of him. I'd never really spoke. I'd never met him. I never spoke with him. I knew of him by sight, his picture, but I'd never. And so when he was elected, it was like, okay, well, let's see. Is he going to be able to keep the feuding parties alive? Because there are factions within the ACNA who wished to burn down the building.
They're small, but on each side of the issue, the elephant issue.
They're very loud. They're very loud, and they are who they are.
Yeah.
And so the new Archbishop of the ACNA they've not eliminated these tensions. They've just had a man of character and strength who is able to unite the disparate factions with a greater vision than the parochial short-term interests of particular parties. Now, the problem is there are some real dead fish in the House College of Bishops of the ACNA. And there are a few real out-and-out idiots. I'm sure they're very nice men.
They're probably wonderful bishops, but would they make a wonderful archbishop?
Some of these guys who I have in mind, knew.
I can think of five. I'm like scratching my head. Please don't.
So, yeah, you know, there is the possibility that they could pick the Joker. Mm-hmm. But then again, I don't know everybody. And God... we'll see how God's spirit moves among the College of Bishops.
But here's where I want to back up. Through biblical history, we know that even picking the Joker, if that's the Holy Spirit's desire, that's a winning move. Because they will transform that Joker into the servant that God needs for that church.
Or it could be like Francis.
Yes. I don't get that Francis.
Basically pick the Joker is the last pope who manages to destroy the church before the Antichrist comes.
I know. So
are we going to get the ACNA Antichrist, or are we going to get the Vicar of Christ?
Hold on. To our audience, keep this in your prayers. Pray that the Holy Spirit leads the College of Bishops. Okay, continue on.
Contrast that to the Episcopal Church, where at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter who the presiding bishop is. Because it's machine that runs the show.
Absolutely.
Now, it matters on one level. Catherine Jefferts Schori was the best thing that ever happened to Kevin and George, because she just gave an unending source of enjoyment and quotes and silly actions and scary actions, and we could talk every single day about her latest craziness. Hmm. Michael Curry is a personally nicer man, but he put a smiley face on the trajectory of decline. He had his little hobby horses, racism and this and that, but he wasn't as colorfully inane as Jefferts Schori. But the trajectory of the Episcopal, unless there is a movement of the Holy Spirit within the collective hearts, the House of Bishops of the Episcopal Church, we're going to have the same old, same old. And that same old is going to continue to gracefully manage the decline. We'll see St. Thomas Fifth Avenue writ large in the National Episcopal Church.
Yeah.
Now, just like there are faithful, you know, gospel Christians at St. Thomas Fifth Avenue and wonderful work being done and some wonderful clergy there, just as there are wonderful churches and wonderful clergy and even a few good bishops in the Episcopal Church. And we're talking about the institution as a whole. And this faithful remnant needs to hold fast to what God has entrusted to them and just pray that the Lord bring revival, reform, and renewal to the world around them and their church around them.
Yeah, indeed. This is going to, I mean, it's a big summer, both for the Episcopal Church and the ACNA. Now, I don't know if a presiding bishop can cause the Episcopal Church to change course. That's probably, you need much more than a presiding bishop to save the Episcopal Church. Am I right?
Well, oh yeah. I mean, you know, at the 2003 primates meeting in London after the election of Gene Robinson, Frank Griswold promised to block Robinson's election, block his
nomination. Yeah, that's right.
It had already been elected by and affirmed. It had been elected by the diocese, affirmed by the General Convention, and Griswold promised publicly to his peers he would not this though, because they would say if you do this, the game was over. Well, he got home and he was told by the other bishops, you can't block this, you must do this. Now, Frank Griswold could have perhaps headed off the crisis, but the crisis would have still arisen anyway. Yeah. Because if Griswold didn't do it, Jeffrey Shorey certainly would have done it.
And that's why we don't want to pick on Gene Robinson. If it wasn't Gene, it would have been somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know, this was always going to happen with this trajectory of the Episcopal Church. It was, you know, and the fact that we don't, do we have a trans bishop yet? I know we have trans
priests.
No,
it's the Lutherans who had the trans
bishop. That's right. Okay, all right. But it can't be that far away.
It was in San Francisco and she got fired. I think it was the Lutherans.
I think it was the Lutherans.
She got fired for racism against Hispanics.
That's right. Boy.
Lutherans, that's right. Bishop of San Francisco.
All right. So if there's anything you need to be on your knees for, it's praying for the changing the trajectory of the Episcopal Church and the new Archbishop of the ACNA. God have mercy on his soul. It's still going to be hard. So let's move on to some other news here. Global South. Oh, boy, this is going to be a tough one. But the Global South meeting this June is in a monastery outside of Alexandria. And they're going to sit down and set an agenda for the Anglican Communion. What? I thought only primates meetings could do that, or only Lambeth could do that, or only Justin Welby himself could do that. Well, not really. So let's talk a little bit about who the Global South are, just to new people to the program, and what effect they would have if they were to de facto express more power into the Anglican Communion. George, who are they?
The Global South are a group of churches predominantly below the equator. That's where you get the South from.
South from, yeah.
But it also includes people like the Anglican Church in North America. Basically, it's GAFCON plus.
Right.
The GAFCON churches plus other churches who are not in the GAFCON orbit. The GAFCON, at its meeting in Kigali last year, basically decided to focus on the work of the church, the project management of the church. The Global South is going to be the group of churches that sort of fights the political and organizational battles for the soul of the communion. And on the big level, the high view is that they are rejecting the neo-Christianity practiced by the liberal churches in the north. and that they believe the church's focus should be on proclaiming the gospel, not social justice. Welby and the Anglican left have a Marxist worldview in their minds. Now, what do I mean by Marxist worldview? They believe that Welby and company believes that mankind can be perfected in this lifetime by social action, and that the church's job is to march shoulder to shoulder with the world towards the utopia that man can create. Well, the Global South believes that that is a lie. That is Satan, that is satanic, that is the sin of Lucifer. It's a sin of pride that we are little gods. And it believes that the work of the church is proclaiming the gospel and good news of Jesus Christ, first and foremost, and leaving the social action and agenda. And, you know, Justin Welby's a member of the World Economic Forum, for instance. He goes to that and gives, you know, high-minded speeches and, you know, about helping forge a new global order.
Climate change, mosquito nets. All that stuff. Yeah.
Now, this is not to say that those things are not important in themselves, but the work of the church as an institution is not to do the job of secular agencies and groups, but rather it is proclaim first and foremost Jesus Christ. And there will be seminars on mission and discipleship at the Global South meeting, economic empowerment, leadership formation, but these are all in the context of proclaiming the gospel. Now you could say, well, economic empowerment, well, that's teach a man to fish instead of giving him fish, preventing the Anglican world from becoming a reproduction of Haiti, where we've sent aid for hundreds plus years and the people have never been able to get out of their pathologies. So that the, you know, self, this is very unfashionable, but it's the old Booker T. Washington approach to poverty. Educate yourself, work hard, build, save, honor, duty, integrity, all founded upon the gospel saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. So this is an important meeting. There's always, however, the possibility that it gets hijacked by staff. You saw this, Kevin, when you went to an all-Anglican meeting.
All-African meeting. Yeah, and it was... Everybody went there for the right intention to find a way to grow the church on the continent of Africa, and the somehow United Nations and other people got involved, and boom, it was it turned into a mosquito net. What size is right for you meeting? Yeah.
And the Global South primates, you know, let's say you're Justin Bodirama, the primate of South Sudan. You're living with government dysfunction, tribal warfare, incursions by the Sudan government. Crisis is still going on in Darfur. You've got a lot of social issues that need to be addressed. Yeah. And so the temptation there is always when somebody says, okay, I'll give you $1 million
yep.
for mosquito net program.
Let us talk.
That's something. Yep. Let's talk. Yep. But for Justin Bodirama, he's got to hold fast. And he has so far that no, the first proclamation is the gospel, because when this money comes, along with it comes strings that are attached. Now, the Central Africans, for instance, are notorious for taking money from the USPG and Trinity Wall Street and doing these public projects and saying in public international forums, the right stuff that Episcopal Church and Church of England wants to hear, but then they go home and they basically repudiate everything they've said to the foreigners because to the because they need the money to, you know, get things moving. That's something the Central Africans are going to have to deal with eventually, but the Ugandans have been quite clear over the last 2-3 decades. You know, if you want, you, yes, we have all these needs, orphanages, clean water, this and that. But if you give us money and then you decide, then tell us we must vote this way or say these things, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah. Well, we should see. And I said South to South encounter. It wasn't. It was all Africa meeting. I want to clear that up. South to South was something I attended in Singapore. It was a great meeting. The and all African I did in Kampala. So,
and the and for the doubters and the naysayers, oh well, you know, we never give demands or quid pro quo. At the 1998 Lambeth Conference, I took a taxi with Ron Haynes, the Bishop of Washington, back from Canterbury to Gatwick Airport, and Ron was livid. Because he said, we in Washington have sent so much money to the Church of Uganda, and we told them what we wanted them to do on the human sexuality vote, and they did not pay any attention to us. And by God, I'm going to make sure they don't get another dime out of us. I mean, I heard Ron Haynes, the Bishop of Washington, you know, say this to me in the anger of the in the aftermath of the vote on human sexuality. And it's no secret. That's just how it works. Yeah. We're not allowed to say that out publicly because it impugns the integrity of both parties.
And for people new to the program, Lambeth 98 is where Lambeth 110 was voted in. Mm-hmm. And so it's crazy, George. Let's move on. Do we have one more story here? No, that's it. That's it. Holy cow, we're done 10 minutes early. People, why don't you...
I've got the Indian corruption.
We'll put that at bay. People, why don't you guys record two-hour shows? Basically, at our age, our bladders and prostates can handle about 1 hour of sitting, George. I don't mean to speak for you, but I'm speaking for myself. 1 hour is my limit. I'm Kevin Cole. Oh, wait. Stop. We need to raise money, okay? I'm sending George my executive editor at large to La Trobe, but I need some money to do it. I'm imagining you a grand or two to would help. I'm probably up to $300. You guys have been really gracious, but please go to anglican.inc/donate and help us with the cause. We need to raise at least another 70% of funds to get him there. I don't want him to have to take a little taxi from Egypt up there. We want to fly him up there and be more comfortable. So go to anglican.inc/donate and give to the cause to send George to La Trobe. I'm Kevin Coulson.
If we've got the money, I've been asked if I would go to the Egypt meeting. Oof. But again, you know, that's expensive. And,
hey, maybe Tech will send you as a reporter.
No.
Don't probably. Yeah, okay. It's time to, I mean, we haven't really asked for money since like 2019 because basically Anglican TV operations have changed since then. I'll be going to Julian Dobbs' Diocesan Convention, so I'm trying to raise money for that, but they're going to help with the plane ticket. So it's time to start refunding Anglican TV and Anglican Unscripted and Anglican.inc as we start operations post-COVID. I'm Kevin Coulson.
And I'm George Conger, and you've been watching episode 848 of Anglican Unscripted.